Sweet Bean, Julieta, Tale of Tales, Summer in 92, Uzumasa a Limelight, The Tip of the Iceberg, A Pigeon Sat on a Branch Reflecting on Existence, A Man Called Over, Winter on Fire, and The Brand New Testament. Which of these will be our films of the year? It's episode 60, season greetings to you, Paul.
And to you.
Even though you don't give a toss.
No, I don't. I don't do Christmas.
And of course to all of you who do care. And thank you very much for joining us once again. Paul, this is the last time we will be doing this just by ourselves.
Indeed.
As the team expands and you slink away to the world of work. Although, even though we all work, but you seem to work a little bit more than most, which is a bit ironic all of a fucking sudden.
It's just harder for me.
It's harder for you.
That's what it is.
You can't blame a wheelchair for everything.
I work less, but actually it's all harder for me.
But that being said, Paul, and actually, bearing in mind this is the last time we're going to be doing this together, I actually think it's really nice that, for my money at least, this is the best final list we've ever had.
I would agree with an exception.
And, well, if it wasn't...
And you don't know what that exception is.
If it wasn't for one film in particular, it would be a perfect list. And I'm betting we haven't got the same idea on that. But now, the thing is about this list is that, I mean, let's give away a slight trade secret before we get onto it. Even amongst all the nominees, all of these 10, I only watch a few of them again because I know which ones are potential winners or not for me, which I think is fair enough. Mm-hmm. Now, in all the other lists we've done, I've only ever rewatched one or two films. To be honest here, I had to rewatch 5. And in fact, 6, because I thought I was being a bit harsh on one of them. So I've actually I wasn't. So yeah, 5. And to be honest, I was actually torn until a relatively late minute as well. And some of them went further up in my estimations after a second viewing, while some of them went down. Don't know about yourself, Paul, but do you actually think that watching a film a second time is actually quite important for this?
I think it is. And I think it's always useful to see what you like and whether it stands up to... The test of a quality film is that you can watch it a second or third time and see more.
Yes. Which is where my winner came from, actually. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, well, again, for the final time, and it will be the last time you hear these rules, because, you know, you're used to it in the fourth year, at least, for next year, when myself, Alex and Eric. A quick reminder of the rules, anyway, before we get going. Only films reviewed on the podcast count, and they must have been a film of the week separately or jointly, between myself and Paul. And, of course, we are only talking about films released on screen, on disc, or at a film festival or an award ceremony in 2016. Paul, let's begin, shall we?
Indeed.
Somewhat of a sombre moment, but also a celebratory moment of as we say goodbye to each other in some sort of celebratory way, really. And it's a nice film to start off with, Sweet Bean. It's a pancake stall. It's about a pancake stall owner who, when he takes on an elderly woman as his part-time assistant, the relationship blossoms further into something more than just boss and co-worker, as secrets begin to reveal themselves. Paul, you didn't get a go on this because this was a podcast of myself and my new co-presenter Eric Hillis did, so I will come over to you shortly. But just to repeat what the kind of things I said about it last time, really. It's a lovely, lovely film. It's a film as much about the perhaps evil heart of Japanese society as it is about the beauty of the place. There are lots and lots of shots showing the fantastic blossom that we all know too well. The changing of the seasons come across nicely in this film. The cleanliness of the location, which I believe is in Kyoto, though I'm not entirely sure. The tranquility and the beauty of the film's location comes across really, really nicely. And then, of course, you've got the food. The love of Japanese cuisine. They love their own food. We love their food. Everyone loves Japanese food. And their cinema is always full of it, at least in part. And, of course, in this film, the importance of food is left, right and centre, really. As we've often seen before. I suppose the film's central theme comes best for me from a letter that Tokyuei, the elderly woman, writes to Sentao, the owner of the pancake store, played by the perfect Masatoshi Nagase, after she eventually decides to quit after rumours about her leprosy spread. And of course, if that's a spoiler to you, then you should have seen all of these films already. But anyway, she says... We try to live our lives beyond reproach, but sometimes we are crushed by the ignorance of the world. Beautiful sentiment, and the fact that both she and he use the safety of a little dorayaki shop to hide away from their problems, as well as that of the world, in a way just to kind of shut yourself off from it all, as the two bonded over the making of the bean paste, which was a beautiful few scenes, a good 10-15 minutes, literally looking into the bowl where they were making the bean paste. And then, of course, how opening the service window essentially lets the evil in. which is when the rumours start to spread and actually results in, at one point, the elderly woman putting a beckoning cat figurine in the window to kind of ward the evil off. Very interesting point of view. It's an emotional film with a lightness of touch that, dare I say, only a female director can truly do justice to, and she does it greatly. It's a quality product for me, Paul.
I think it's an exceptional film,
yeah.
Actually. I think it's emotional and moving, like you say. But I think the key is that at its heart, it has a sense of humanity,
yes,
that transcends its subject. And I think it's both about nature and our place within the world,
yeah,
and the world within the place of our own lives, our own people, our own society, and of humanity in itself. I think it has some very nice touches. I won't say what they are because I don't want to give any spoilers, but I don't think the leprosy one is a particular one. You know, you do realise fairly, sort of not that long in, that there's a problem. But I think it avoids cliche, and that's one of,
yes,
the things. So there was a bit at the beginning, and I thought, oh, it's going to come back, and this is going to happen with that. Da, da, da. As you do, you try and guess the plot, and it didn't happen. But actually, what it did do is something else happened. It's in relation to the trees. That actually transcended the cliche and made it even more meaningful and more beautiful. And you had to work for that yourself, and I really, really liked that. I think the performances were exceptional. I think it was beautifully directed in a kind of subtle. It didn't feel slow, even though it's 1 hour 53, and you know I have a thing about time. And I think everyone performs well. Yeah. The main lead, male lead, the old woman and the young woman, they're a fantastic little ensemble. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so I think it is a truly exceptional film, and I'm disappointed I didn't get to see it throughout the year, and I was only doing it for this. Because, I'm disappointed that, and again, this is one of two countries of which we've got two films from,
yep,
that country on it. And there's so little seen of that country's film, Japan's films, that it is heartbreaking. And what's quite interesting is when I was your age,
yep,
we did see a lot of Japanese films.
Yes, that's right.
Actually, which was quite interesting. And now we don't. And I think that's a true tragedy.
But again, I think, the Japanese tour foundation, the film tour that they do every single year, where they bring maybe 10 to 12 films over. And in our neck of the woods, we get to go to the Mac and see them. More about that way at the end, because that's going to involve one of the films that I can't wait to see. But yeah, it's everything you say is and more, really. I mean, you talked about the beginning scenes. Just the most perfect characterisation in these opening scenes of this film.
Indeed.
You know so much about this lead guy without him saying a word.
Yep.
You see him having a cigarette above on his apartment block. You see a scan of the city, the town. You know that he's a bit miserable, a bit of a recluse. And you then go and see him at work and you see that he's equally as miserable doing that. So but again, not a single word is spoken. Mm. It's just beautiful, beautiful stuff. I think we're both move on quite happy to say that Sweet Bean deserves a place on this list.
Indeed.
And
indeed,
we should salute Eric Hillis for making us both watch it.
We should.
And we'll hear him, of course, more of him next year out. Paul, Giulietta, please. Well, Giulietta.
Giulietta is the Almodovar movie
yep.
that came out this year, and it was a joint film of the week
for
the pair of us. And
it was an easy decision as well, wasn't it? We had some awful ones that week.
It was.
The Search and other awful ones.
Obviously your selection that week.
Yeah.
But it's basically about a woman, and it comes forward and back in time. A woman who doesn't see her daughter anymore, and she had a problem with her. The daughter left, didn't want to see her. And then you flash back to her meeting her boyfriend in La Coruña,
yeah,
in northern Spain, on a beautiful coastal setting, and what happened in that relationship, and about death, etc. And it's kind of pseudo kind of melodramatic chick lit thriller, I suppose is a good way to describe it. It's not worth going too much into the plot because it sort of weaves in and out of time, place. You meet people, she travels a bit, she's trying to find her daughter. There's also about someone wants to go out with her now and she can't go out, and the trauma of the past. But the point is Almodovar is back at his best in this.
Yes.
I've always been a big admirer of him, although he has moved very much into the kind of screaming hysterical melodrama over the last few films. And this is a truly, truly great film. And it fell in with the fact that we've been looking at throughout the year the work of Fritz Lang.
Yeah.
And the sparseness of the cast and the situations and the mise-en-scene that he perfected in all of his truly great films, and those black and white Hollywood films, the noir films, that he captures here in this, in absolute colour. And that's the joy of, to me, Almodovar, is he does what Fritz Lang did with darkness and shallow light. He does with glorious colour and brightness, and does it just as well. And I think this is a truly good film. And the fact that it isn't on the foreign language Oscar thing is truly,
yeah,
truly
well,
astounding.
We're going to mention that later at the end. Yes, Almodovar, a director I've always respected, but not actually liked enough to collect his stuff.
Mm.
Though, like yourself, I've seen a whole host of his films as a result, and this is, as you correctly said, a real return to form. His best film in about a decade by my collection.
Absolutely.
Beautifully constructed, wonderful cinematography, and as you so accurately said, the use of colours, the warmth, the reds and the like, typical from him, but still wonderful. It's quite slow, but actually a good slow. It kind of draw you into all the characters, and there are quite a fair few of them. I actually, and I'm going to compare this to another film already on this list, A Man Called Over and the use of flashbacks. I much preferred the use of flashbacks in this film because it isn't sentimental. There's no fucking piano music when people are talking. This is a much classier film than that, more enchanting and just better than A Man Called Over.
It's different.
And yet, that has made the shortlist for the Oscars, and not this fucking film, The Bastards. What the hell?
It is odd.
But no, it's great, and everyone acts well in it again, which is a kind of a common theme for great films, really, surprise, surprise. It's just the twists and turns, I should say, some surprises along the way, and it doesn't quite end how you think it's going to end. To a point, it's splendid, and thoroughly recommended from both of us yet again. Tale of Tales is the new film from the Italian director. I'm a bit nervous about this one because of your history of fairy tales. It's the new film from Italian director Matteo Garrone that basically takes centuries-old tales from Neapolitan writer Giambattista Basile and puts them all together to make one long interlocking tale. The three stories involved are about a queen who resorts to necromancy to bear a child, a king that befriends a flea, and an old ugly woman who by magic gains a youth and beauty. Paul, this film, for me, is this year's director's accomplishment. I'm a fan of him anyway, and we've done a couple of his other films, actually, I believe. And thankfully, you're not going to be on the podcast for his next one. Oh dear, you wait until you... Well, I think you already know which film I'm going to have a go at. I think I've already had half a go anyway. But this was his first flourish with a budget, his first flourish with a star cast, his first use of a significant green screen, and his first English language film. So not even, you know, the fact that he succeeds at all of the above, considering that I would have doubts he'd be able to succeed at any of it, is brilliant. I was really, really impressed with his performance in this. And for me, it's a fantastically entertaining film anyway. I like all the stories and how they're interwoven. Everyone acts well in it. Above all else, the lord of the silver screen himself, Toby Jones, who literally can do no wrong. There's hardly anything at all I would change about it, frankly. It's impressive visually, it succeeds narratively, it's funny, it's emotional. Myself and Alex both connected to different stories and is able to do that. I like the choices of stories, actually, because they fit in really well with today's society. How everyone needs to conform to marriage, the importance of looks, etc., etc., wealth and all the rest of it. Universal themes, yet intrinsically Italian. Just like this film is essentially American in many ways. English language, big budget, big cast. But it still has got a little bit more flair than that. Garrone really understands the literature that he's using. I would highly recommend for all ages this one, Paul. And I know you're going to have a great time agreeing with me now.
Well, obviously, this is the worst film of the entire collection. I do have a problem with fairy tales.
Yes.
Particularly shallow, pointless, shite ones, which is what I would say all of these are. And again, I'm a big fan of Toby Jones. I quite like Vincent Cassell, and I quite like Sam Hayek. and John C. Reilly, whatever his
name
is.
Yes, John C. Reilly, yeah.
And what on earth were they doing in this? What on earth? I presume it was 3 months in an Italian city having a great time.
Yes.
And I can, I'm sure they had a fantastic time.
They made a bloody great film out of it.
This is dreadful. It's a little portmanteau film, so there's three separate stories, is it? It's as boring as hell. It's 2 hours and 13 minutes long, and it feels 2 hours and 30 minutes long. And I think it's just like, as if, what would I say, Tales of the Unexpected, which was a big hit when I was a child.
Yes.
Of, you know, Roald Dahl, which was just a bit, you know, like, have a little narrative and then something odd will happen at the end and you'll think, oh, that was interesting. And I know that, for example, Number 9 try and do that nowadays on British television, which is equally drivel. And so I was incredibly disappointed. I didn't think anybody performed particularly well. It was all fairly narrow and crass. Its use of the kind of albino twins was a bit odd. The giant was very cliched. It didn't break out anything original whatsoever. I did like one performance, and that was how she changed throughout the thing, and that was Toby Jones's daughter as the princess.
Oh, yes.
I quite liked her, and I thought she was very good. But actually, then the way it all came back together at the end and in kind of brought it into the thing was just crass, cliched, and I was genuinely surprised that this was as awful as I thought it was. If you like fairy tales, you're not very imaginative. It's kind of like it's Disney by an Oxford Cambridge graduate that's a bit clever, and that's about it. The visual,
the best thing is,
but even the green screen I thought was pretty second rate stuff.
A lot better than one of the other films coming off, by the way.
Quite possibly, but I did think there was, and I'm genuinely surprised, and it wasn't just because it's fairy tales, because fairy tales can be exceptional, witty or funny. This did nothing. You know, even The Princess's Bride by Rob Reiner is better than this.
Well, I'm going to completely disregard everything that you've said for one very, very important reason, which I forgot to mention, actually, is that the tales by the Neapolitan poet Giambattista Basile are actually the earliest versions of Rapunzel, Sleeping Beauty and Cinderella. So they're not original at all. And they're never striving to be, and this film was never striving to be an original piece.
But then you've got to do something different with it, and it doesn't. It doesn't do anything.
But you know, what could it have done then?
Well, it could have done anything. It could have focused on one of the stories and gone into kind of like grotesque detail. I think that would have been better. I'll give you an example.
That's been done.
Were scary, and that's the whole point about fairy tales, and we've sanitised them through Disney and all that kind of shit. And there was the bit where they flay the woman. The English actress, Shirley Henderson, actually, who I do quite like. They flay her and she just looks a bit messy. And you thought, oh, God, no, give me a break.
But the focusing on one tale and making it into a thing has been done. Putting three of them together hasn't been done.
Yes.
So, where then?
It's dreadful.
Where?
Oh, any portmanteau movie, you know.
Not yet, any portmanteau movie.
It's just...
Well, that's a cop-out. I need names,
well,
please.
Well, it's funny. I'd have to think about it. But I'll think about it. I try and blank them. That's what I try and do.
Think about it, but of course you won't be back next year. So let me know in private.
Just make sure that when we do something together, we don't do one of this bloke's films.
We will be doing his next film, but you won't be here to enjoy it.
Thank God for that.
Summer in 92.
Summer in 92. Well, basically, this is the story of the Danish football team, a national team, winning the Euros in 1992. It's a fairly conventional story. It stars Ulrika Thomsen, who we did in The Collective.
Yes.
Recently, one of the great Danish actors. He's also
and the Commune, of course.
Exactly, and he's been in a lot of Hollywood stuff as well. He's actually in The Blacklist with James Spader at the moment, which is a bit surreal to see him.
Yeah, great actor.
One has to do stuff for money. I'm sure he gets
and one
more...
has to smile now and again. I think he's still trying, though.
I'm sure he gets more money for doing The Blacklist than he does for his entire year.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Of great Danish cinema. Anyway, so it's basically the story of the manager who was... Who wasn't a very successful manager to start with as the national team, but they kept him because they couldn't get anybody else.
Yep.
And how he goes on, they didn't qualify for the tournament. They were going to sack him, but then they get in because of Yugoslavia's at war. And then they end up going to the tournament, and it's about one of the players. His child dies of cancer, and it's a bit of a tribute to him as well. And it was just a great upbeat film. in a way that wasn't too cliched. It still stuck within its genre, so it's going to deliver kind of genre tropes.
Slow motion shots and that
kind
of thing.
Indeed, and it's always going to do that. It can't not be that. But equally, if you think about what Hollywood do to this, it would be destroy every kind of element of decency within it. So equally, it wasn't too jingoistic either. And again, that's a great thing to be able to do about a football theme, about your nation winning, to not become obsessively jingoistic, but actually talk about it in a different kind of way. So, and the very fact that I think I did this before I was going to the Euros this year in France, and when I come back, and I like it, even more. It's a great upbeat film that I think the whole family can enjoy. If you've got kids who like football, to learn about something they've not seen before, a bit of history. It was a really great film. It's not art, I wouldn't say particularly, but it's original, it's witty, and just really, really enjoyable.
I didn't dislike it at the time, and I still don't dislike it, but I am not the target audience for this film. It's a film for casual football fans, I would say. Moreover, patriotic Danes, a few of which probably won't have even cared about football before Euro 92 happened.
Mm-hmm.
But then they get swept up by it, and it's basically a film about making you remember where you were when Denmark upset the odds to achieve its biggest ever sporting achievement, Paul, particularly if you're Danish. As I said at the time when we reviewed this, I wanted more football, and I stand by that, particularly with regards to the head coach, Molly Nielsen, who you've described correctly. But in real life, he was an absolute tactical and technically, in terms of the fitness, coaching, that kind of thing, he was ahead of his time. He was a genius. But the film would have you believe he was nothing special at all, and that everything happened because of two or three star players.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as a football fan, we know that's not the case. You know that's not the case. But it's not that kind of film, so you ignore all that as best you can. No point getting het up about it. If you're a football fan, you would get something out of this regardless, as I did. For me, it's not even close to being a contender for Film of the Year. But
I'd agree.
It's recommended nonetheless.
Yeah.
And frankly, Paul, it is one of the best football films ever. Indeed. That is an undeniable fact.
And partly the reason for that is because there isn't a lot of football in it.
Yes.
Because that's where football films recreating football always fall down.
But I think they still could have tried, and I think they could have tried. And also, I think the competence of everyone making this. I mean, bloody hell, Ulrik Thomson, alright, he doesn't have to kick anything. But all the other guys, I mean. I think they could have maybe got away with it. Because what's interesting is that, for example, one of the shot that goes past the Dutch goalkeeper, whose name escapes me, is a football fan, which is embarrassing. Although, to be fair, I was only five at the time or whatever. The shot that goes past him was apparently near the 100th shot that he did at that point.
John Jensen, was it?
Yeah, the Jensen one. The actor who did that on behalf of John Jensen took him 100 times to do that shot. So I do respect that, and I do like that, but again, I wanted a little bit more football in there. But it ain't that kind of film, and we should be grateful that a football film can actually be half decent like this one.
Absolutely.
So there we go. Uzumasa Limelight, our second and final Japanese entrant on this list this year. It's one of our joint films of the week as well. It's all about a TV studio based in the outskirts of Kyoto, which produces samurai extras and has done for decades. When the new executives decide that the old-style samurai dramas should be replaced with younger actors in order to attract new audiences, we follow the lives of the extras as they get lesser and lesser parts as the world, and indeed the TV studio basically, threatens to leave them behind. It's also loosely based on Charlie Chaplin's Limelight, which I don't think is particularly important, really, do you,
no,
Paul?
No, I don't think it is.
So if you don't know it, like I didn't, it won't make any difference. What is important, though, is that you realise after watching it that this is, again, a lovely, lovely film that I think we both recommend without any hesitation at all. Everyone performs well in it, but none more so than the focal point of the film, Seiichi Kamiyana, played by Seizo Fukumoto, who is just the most perfect face for this film. He carries it. He is the lead old samurai extra that is all the way through this film. He doesn't say a lot, but he doesn't need to. And it was actually wise of the production team to keep it that way, as, again, his face tells you so much scene after scene. The film looks good and it sounds great, and features, as is quite obvious, the atypical Japanese cinematic fare, such as generational gap, old versus new, modernisation versus tradition, the stuff you've heard us speak about so much before. But what I personally get out of this, most of all, Paul, is its most beautiful asset, is that it's a film about respect. In a lot of other films, the generational gap in Japan is seen as a hindrance or a nuisance to development. Here, it's the opposite. The relationship between Kamiyama and the up-and-coming starlet actress blossoms beautifully, as is the gradual acceptance from the older extras, the other extras, that yes, their time has actually come to step aside. Which is harder for them to accept, since the Japanese mentality is basically, hey, I'm here to work and I'm working till I die. Retirement is something only taken as a last possible resort, really. But again, get back to the respect, because there's lots of it. And actually how pretty much everyone has a sense of respect for each other eventually. The executives do come round to a classic way of thinking and responding kind, never patronisingly, always genuinely and from the heart. It's a nostalgic film, but it's never sentimental. It's handled almost perfectly. I say almost because there was one line I would have taken out. And that's when one of the new executives says, in front of a crowd full of people, let's completely forget the old-style samurai dramas and make history. And it may sound harsh of me to bring up one line of dialogue in a film that's nearly, how long is it? Just shy of two hours long. But it's an incredibly heavy-handed line in the film that is never that. It's such a beautifully made film, beautifully poised, acted, delivered. Again, not sentimental, but nostalgic in the best possible way. And the film never ever reaches that level of harshness after the line and before the line. So if it wasn't for that line, then this film would be even better than it is. And unfortunately, that line does stick out for something to remember. But overall, Paul, a blessedly wonderful film.
I would agree completely. I think, again, it's up there as one of the great films of the year. I think it's very interesting. It's Japanese again. I think the thing that I liked most about it is that it is about nostalgia, but it's about how we construct nostalgia through the fantasy of the media often, because that's what he is. He's an extra who does samurai movies that are of the past, being taken over by a new version of what that should be. So the creation of a new version of the past it's in, and the passing of that. So even the versions of the past are being transcended to new versions of the past in new versions of the future. And that kind of multi-layered level of insight and playfulness, again, with the true kind of understanding of the humanity of growing old, impending kind of physical, pathological failure, death to some extent, and to do with the kind of notions of how Japanese society is evolving, it couldn't be better. I didn't mind that line because I thought it showed there are crass people everywhere.
Yes.
And I quite
maybe
liked
a little bit more of it then would have been fine.
Yeah, but I think it would, again, if you'd have made more of it, it would have made it a bit unbalanced. But I think it was about, to me, showing that it wasn't totally unaware of the fact that there's a lot of media industry who are just like dismissive of everything in the past. I quite like the mixing of the young and the old, the hopeful and the delusional, and the kind of people who work hard and the people who expect it to be given to them. I liked its use of kind of like the notion of what media is, and I think, but equally, the central character of the old man coming to the end of his time and having literally to pass the baton on, in a kind of very literal sense, but equally a metaphorical and emotional one of transcendence of his own life, was just fantastic. And again, a double bill with Sweet Bean would be an absolute dream.
Indeed. I mean, it was a dreamlike film, though. I mean, indeed. I love the bit where he took the young starlet actress up to the hill, or they were walking together in the hill, because I think he then retired to the hills to go back on his farm. And then just the landscape was fantastic. And then you had some children running with swords, and it was... But again, all that kind of stuff, harking back, never, never sentimental. Just the best possible kind of nostalgia. And as you mentioned, a new form of new. Well, we see this in the film, of course, again, when the newer generation come in with their rather pathetic CGI samurai swords.
Yeah.
And then they quickly ditch those and then go back to the old-style samurai swords that are new. So, you know, both of us are absolutely bang on this. It is a splendid, splendid film. And this has an average rating of 4.8 out of 10 on IMDb. Concerning.
Indeed.
Concerning.
Indeed.
Just like it would be concerning, Paul, to work for the company in our next film. La punta del iceberg, the tip of the iceberg. We'll keep this one brief because we obviously talked about it very recently.
Indeed, this was, I think, my film of the week.
It was.
And basically it's about a woman who's employed to go and look at how a company is being worked and managed because of a number of suicides within that company. Very interesting today that a single person in a company in Japan committed suicide and the chief executive resigned because that person was overworking. Brilliant stuff. The thing about this...
suicide is not brilliant stuff, but another.
No. but that taking responsibility.
Yes, of course. Yes,
and
of course.
Actually the seriousness of that.
Yeah, of
that
course.
We don't accept in this country. We have stigma to suicide or whatever. So she's investigating the suicide. She does it through meeting individuals. Then she imagines the kind of scenarios that were happening to the people who are committing suicide, finds out how the company runs. You never know what the company makes. You find out so little and yet you learn so much. And then about how companies try and hide how they're treating their staff, etc. And it all comes together in this kind of perfect little ensemble film. Not many characters, 5 or 6. Just very, very focused on looking at the kind of nature of work in contemporary society and how, you know, it leads people to suicide. And I just thought it worked incredibly well, very effectively. It wasn't slow, given its subject and the kind of very few people in it, very few characters. It was well acted. It wasn't too melodramatic. It wasn't overly kind of sensationalist either. And I thought it just worked really, really well. And again, I don't think it's even going to come out here or whatever. And so, but I'd recommend it completely. It's not the depressing kind of film that you would imagine either. Oh, isn't suicide? It's not that kind of melodrama. It's very factual, investigative, as well as imagining. And there is a little bit of the personal story of the individuals involved. No film would be a film without, you know, you meet someone who you used to shag, etc. kind of thing. But to actually, it worked exceptionally well. And I would recommend it wholeheartedly.
I would. Just to kind of repeat what we said last time, it's a very good, highly polished film. It's not a great film for me because it used the hallucinate. It went down the whimsy hallucination route. Totally unnecessary. She's interviewing people who don't exist in front of her, or she sees a different face that's there, or she sees one of the people commit suicide and then she gets blood on her and then she wakes up, although she wasn't ever sleeping. That shit, just not do it. It's such a shame because it's not a film about that, really, at all.
Well, I think I would agree to the extent that actually you could see it as that it wasn't an hallucination, it was her imagining it, except they did the bit with the blood, which moves it into the arena of hallucination, and they should have kept it as her envisaging the narrative that she'd been given and been much clearer on
because
that.
She was learning the story as we were learning the story, what went on, so therefore she's cooking up it in her own head as we're cooking it up our heads, but she went that again, the bloody things step too far. This is just my show. I love about it though is the depoliticisation of it.
Yep.
It's not particularly anti-capitalist by any means. It's sympathetic towards both points of view, obviously. You know, from your side and my side would be very different. But that's why I think we can both enjoy this film. I see it as, well, actually, there are things you can do not to have to put up with that shit anymore. As from your point, I'll just fucking kill yourself and just don't work for a shit company like that anyway.
Yep.
So it pleases everyone. And this is easily my biggest surprise of the year. When I read that you wanted us to watch it, I thought, okay, how good can it really be? It's Spanish. It's going to be a bit slow. It might have some crap humour in there. And there was actually one or two decent bits of humour in there that were kind of something to do with a vending machine and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Little bits and pieces that just cut through the harshness and everything else quite nicely. So, again, recommending by both. I have no problems at all saying that with the tip of the iceberg. Now then, a pigeon sat on a branch reflecting on existence. I can't remember. I think we both... Was this one that we didn't both have a go on again? It was kind of put... I can't actually remember. I think we both had a go, didn't we? I can't quite remember. Anyway, it's a joint film of the week, yeah? And it's basically a film about life in Sweden through a bunch of absurdist episodes, or, if you want, vignettes, 49 of them to be exact, mainly following a couple of novelty mask salesmen. Paul, where to start with this piece of art? Which is what this is. It's very funny. It's extremely emotional at times. There are so many absolutely genial moments in this film. it's hard to single some out, but, you know, again, spoilers, here we go. The cafe scenes involving the horse marches in Swedish history, which took 2 months to film, and the scenes are probably about 4 minutes long. I love that. Got a lot of time for that. Then another bar goes back to 1943 to see the soldiers and them drinking as a group, and then the singing that happened there. But then how that changes to the modern day, and actually how very little of that bar has changed. And it says so much about what Mr. Roy Anderson is saying about his own country here, and you'll be able to fill this in about his other films that he's done a similar kind of thing in. The huge monster scene where we see a huge copper furnace. And we didn't spoil it at the time, but now we can. A huge copper furnace that they put loads of black people in. Inscribed Boliden, which is basically a message about the Swedish mining and smelting company Boliden, which sold thousands of tons of smelting residue to Chile in the 1980s, only to face a lawsuit claiming hundreds of people, including children who played on the waste sites when they were poisoned. And so they then became poisoned. And yet, because black people were used in this film, send such a powerful message to how Swedish people treat their immigrants poor. Mm. And as an absolute bonus to that, they're being watched being put into this massive copper furnace with wealthy white people drinking in tuxedos, which is just a perfect sentiment. And add to all that, something that I'm not going to give him too much credit for, because he had no idea what was happening, but this was put forward for the Oscar ceremony, hashtag Oscar so white. Again, he had no idea that was going to happen, and we can fully understand, therefore, why they would never, ever have put this film on the final list, even though it bloody should have been, and frankly, it should have won. But talking about colour, this film has an amazing lack of colour throughout.
Indeed.
The film is entirely beige, both inside and out. And it looks fantastic. I would know if any other films had done this, I would love to know. The lack of dialogue, the dryness, the wit, the self-deprecation, everything we associate with the very best of Scandinavian cinema is in this film. It's a film all about the pointlessness of everything, which I know is a subject close to your heart. But, as well, as much as it is about that, it's also about appraising itself. And everyone in Sweden, in whatever, for just getting on with it. But it's also a film, for me, about love, a little bit of lust in there, but friendship, because we see the kind of friendship develop between the two novelty salesmen. They kind of have, they work together, and then they fall out, then they come back together in sort of really strange corridor scene where people have to get up early in the morning. It's just absolutely great stuff. And the fact that it can resonate so sublimely with a non-Swede is good enough. But I gather if you're Swedish, Paul, you get even more out of it.
Absolutely, and this is the third in and final part of a trilogy. If you look up the director, I've forgotten what the other two are called, but I think we did
The Living is one of them, and I can't remember the other one.
Yeah, but and I think we did do the second one. I'm not sure we did the first one, because it's taken like a decade to do all three. It takes an awful long time, as you can tell from taking the 4 months to do the one scene. But that's the thing about these; they are art.
Yeah,
they are truly works of art. In the way they are painted, designed, coloured, the choreography of the animals, the environment, the buildings, and all of that together to create a kind of scathing indictment in a kind of lightly humorous way about the kind. It's very kind of nihilist, existentialist, the pointlessness of life, but equally that, you know, it's life and you just got to get on and enjoy it and love and lust. And all of those kind of things. And, you know, you've said it all. And I think, you can't sit and watch all three of an afternoon. Because you would want to top yourself at the end. Plus, you'd be so overwhelmed by it. But that kind of episodic nature works so well. And although the film is like 1 hour 41, there's 40-odd episodes within it. Characters coming in and out that you've seen before,
interlocking in all the other tales as well.
Absolutely, yeah. And it works so perfectly. But I think it needs to be said, it is film as art.
Yes,
and it's not film as a kind of narrative entertainment. It's film as art. But this Roy Anderson has perfected that to almost a kind of supreme level. There's very little dialogue in it.
No, there isn't.
You know, we talk about the little dialogue within the Japanese ones. And again, throwing songs in there as well. And I think a truly great filmmaker, I think they tell you at the script, it's called show it, don't say it.
Yeah.
And these, the two Japanese films we've done, and this director, Roy Anderson, they show it. They don't talk about it.
Yeah.
They don't describe it. It just is, and it's absolutely perfection. A must.
Absolutely a must. And not only is it all the serious things we're talking about, it's also incredibly silly. Like there's like a rubbish scene, but in a good way, of when one of the women actually sees wearing them one of the masks, the horror mask that they're trying to sell, and she just runs out the room screaming. It's a pathetic scene, but it's fantastic. Like and when there's, well, again, I could name all sorts of them here. I will leave some of them for you to enjoy, but when one of them taps their shoe on some kiosk outside of in a park somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And then the person in the kiosk gets really excited. She's got a customer. And then, because the salesman had fell out at that point, so they're essentially gone solo, the salesman just says, "Oh, don't get too excited. She was just cleaning a shoe or something." Just, and then, of course, the whole thing ends with this, "What day is it?" I mean, you can't get any better than that. Just this 10, 15-minute scene of people trying to work out whether it was a Wednesday or a Thursday. It isn't for everyone, but...
There's not a lot happens in Sweden.
It's, I mean... But how amazing that we can both learn so much from a country that... Have you ever been? Because I haven't.
I've been.
Oh, you've been. But it's just great. It really is. It's just perfection, really.
It's exceptional.
Much
like the next film.
Time for my bag of shit film. Time for me to have a good moan after you have your say. A Man Called Over. Go on.
On Man Som Hette Off, as I like to
say. Right, okay.
1 minute 56, that's quite long, which is very unusual for one of mine. And basically it's about a kind of order-obsessed old man who becomes a widow and tries to enforce every kind of association rule in the kind of little community in which he lives. And obviously some interlopers come in who kind of break all of his rules, which are basically a Swede and his immigrant wife and their couple of kids, and how he is broken down by their kind of buoyancy, really. He tries to commit suicide at one point, if not a couple of points. And then you through flashback, you learn his story. And I know you had a problem with...
I'll let you know my problems in a minute.
With the flashbacks. It's quite... And I think it is a problem in the sense that the problem about the flashbacks is about how he met his wife and then, you know, why they didn't have children and how she became what she became and how he did so many things for her. There's flashbacks to the beginning of their relationship, how his father died, which has echoes of the Roy Anderson thing. It's just a moment where, boom, and it happens. And you think, wow. And it's got a lot of humour in it. It's very funny. I think the reason why it's on the Oscar list is Rolf Lassgaard, the main central character who was in fact the Swedish, he was one of the versions of, I've forgotten that detective's name, Valander. He was the original Valander, for example, in a series of Swedish television productions before it was taken over by the other bloke. And he's always good to see. He's made so many great films, great TV series, and that's why it is. But it's funny, it's witty, it's charming. It's not art. It's just a really, really enjoyable film. It helps if you're older. I think that's probably a key thing because I think, and again, if you know a lot of older than yourself as well, people who behave in this kind of anal way, that's just self-destructive. And then it's also about the relationship with his former co-rule obsessed person and how that broke down. There's a lot of disability in this film, actually, as well. There's at least two people in wheelchairs.
And there's me thinking why you'd like it.
And but actually, it's him. And then Rolf Lassgaard is brilliant. I think he's got so much charisma that he carries it, you know, over all of its weaknesses. What I was going to say is about the flashbacks, and it's a problem all films that try and create a period within memory in a flashback, is they're always too clean, too polished. It just doesn't quite work. But, and I could have done with a few less flashbacks, and actually there would have been times where he could have told it rather than shown it. That actually would have been a bit better, as in building the relationship with the young immigrant woman who he teaches to drive. And obviously, you know, it ends kind of both happy and sad in a very Swedish way, that he learns to live and then
dies.
which is very Swedish.
It is, yes. I watched this one twice, as you know.
Obviously, you mean one and a half times, because you didn't watch it to the end last time.
No, one and all a quarter. The first time I didn't reach the end, the second time I did, but I wish I hadn't. This really is one of the most astonishingly mediocre Scandinavian films I've ever seen. It's sickeningly sentimental.
Indeed.
It lacks any humour. I cannot see the humour that you see in it. But worst of all, it's actually got nothing at all to say. It promises to be a film. Actually, one thing I think it wants to say...
You wait till it wins best
film. Oh, fuck. My life is a zucchini. Let's do it. Anyway, more about that in a minute. But it promises to be a film about tolerance, actually. Across ages, across, I don't know, cultures, skin colour, all the rest of it. But, and the reason there is that is because of the Family of Persians movie. And that's what kind of kicks the film into action after a load of nothing fucking shit. But funny
that's
enough,
a technical term.
Nothing
for
fucking
narrative
shit.
Drive.
That's what happens. That's what happens. That's what happens if Elder Shoemaker doesn't edit your films. You get nothing fucking shit. But the problem with the Persian family is that they actually speak Swedish. So therefore, where's the intolerance? Because everyone knows he's a cantankerous old fart. Everyone knows that. So where's the intolerance there? Odd. The rest of it is just one set of flashback after another. Now, this did incredibly well at the Swedish box office, which frightens me.
Well, it was populist entertainment.
But here's the thing.
It wasn't Roy Atkinson.
And to be fair, and you have touched on this, and I was nodding while you were saying it, I think there is a definitive and firm attitude over in Sweden towards elder people that they seem to explore in films regularly and popularly as well. For example, we've also done 100-year-old Man Who Climbed Out the Window and Disappeared. Yeah. Again, I didn't get that either. So I'm actually willing to accept I might be a slight part of the problem here. But equally, just give me a reason to love over, like you obviously did. I didn't, and therefore I just couldn't.
Well, I would agree. If you don't like the central character and can't get him, not necessarily like, but actually, if he doesn't remind you of someone you know or have met, or you give you that hook into it, I can see why you would think this is a bad load of shit. But it was, and again, it's not art. So if it does win, because it's in the shortlist.
Well, that will concern me because that means...
It won't.
No,
because it's populist entertainment and there's nothing wrong in that. And I think that's partly why I quite liked it, because often when we see Swedish films, they're about dubious sexuality, emerging sexuality, rape, abuse, killing...
A crisis for somebody.
Or existentialist angst. And this was just a good, nice populist entertainment. Hollywood will buy this and Hollywood will remake it with someone who is horrible. Probably a bearded Mel Gibson.
Dustin Hoffman.
No, a bearded Mel Gibson. He's looking old now. So, but and I think I just enjoyed it. And I think I enjoyed it. And I think there's probably a lot of films where they are good and they're better, but you don't enjoy it. And I just enjoyed this.
Good for you. I mean, the flashback thing, again, like it was so incredibly daft because... He basically does these flashbacks when he was killing himself.
Yes.
When he's hanging himself, he says, "Oh, my brain works faster and I can remember all this shit." And you're doing that. That one kind of worked. But again, at no point is he going to commit suicide because you only just got into the fucking film. So they can forget that straight away. The worst one, and this is where it really got my tits about the fucking flashbacks, was when he was in the car. He was in the car and he had the hose and the few and all that going into his face. Mm. That flashback lasted for 20 fucking minutes.
Well, it takes a long time to hose yourself.
Well, but here's the thing. Does it really?
Yes.
I mean because...
Don't try this at home, please.
Unless you've just watched A Man Called Ivan, which you've got no choice. But no, I just thought, no. Just horrendously annoying.
I can see why you didn't like it, and I think.
But what concerns me is that I can't see why you did, and that's why we don't have the agreement.
Well, I think
on
because
it,
I've known people like that, and I'm old.
I think that does
make a difference.
As I've admitted, that's fair enough.
Yeah, it's a very personal thing.
So our penultimate film for this year's awards ceremony is Winter on Fire. Again, Paul, you didn't have a say on this when we did it, so I'll be coming over to you in a minute.
Well, let me just start by saying I'm not going to say much. It's an okay documentary.
Well, it's a documentary on the unrest in Ukraine during 2013-2014. A student demonstration supporting European integration grew into a violent revolution calling for the resignation of President Yanukovych, with a particular focus on Maidan Square. Paul, it is definitely the best documentary about Maidan I have ever seen.
Bearing in mind we've seen two,
and the other one, fucking nothing happened.
I preferred the other one.
I know you did. And it's, to be honest, it's actually one of my favourite documentaries I've seen for a long, long time.
You want to get out more.
It has filmed everything you need to see about what happened over these years, and stuff you'd rather not see at all. I can't remember an example of a documentary that actually has that much access. There's nothing missing here. You see all the bloodshed, you see all of the patriotism, nationalism, the passion of the people. The stock footage is also put to good effect as we see things from the parliament, from newsreels. But actually, not an over-reliance on that side of things. Rather, handheld camera stuff from within Maidan itself, and you get a real feel for Maidan. For me, I wanted this to win the Oscar for documentary. Not a lot won with Amy at all, which did win. That was a good documentary. But for me, Paul, this was a great one, to be honest.
It's a good documentary. It was a fairly standard narrative thrust.
Yeah.
It did have good access. I think that it captures more that it was just chaos rather than anything particularly organised by any particular side. I think that one of the problems I had with it is that it kind of like just goes along and then it ends by saying, oh, well, they then went to war and they annexed to Crimea. And it's kind of like, give me a bit more than that. And I think, actually, I would have liked the next bit, because I think the other Maidan film that we saw, Maidan, what it's called, actually gave us a lot of this without the kind of overtness of explanation.
I mean,
But it was okay. You know?
But this has got an American influence, it's got an American budget, it's Netflix exclusive, so it's got all that in its favour and all that helping it out to do more, and it tries to deliver more, and for me it does.
Yeah.
But Maidan just had nothing happen at all, which is...
It was different. It did something
so that,
different.
So that didn't have enough, and this probably had a little bit too much. But,
but it's good, and I would recommend it. I'm not saying anything else.
I've got to be honest, the last 20 minutes of this, very emotionally manipulative, if you got that far, Paul.
I did.
But I'm actually happy to be... And I actually really enjoyed this probably above all else this year. The camera work scans the crowd. You see all the ages. You see all the religious sects. You see the music soars and the camera rises above Maidan Square. And then really, you then contemplate what actually happened there. Yes, it was mostly chaos, and it was sort of organised chaos. There was the Maidan car thing that circling to keep people protected to a point. But it was an absolutely mad couple of years, no doubt. But really, what a great... coming from an anti-socialist, by the way, I'm really impressed with it. It stirred me up, Paul.
You'll be voting later.
I can assure you that's never going to fucking happen. There's such an unbelievable stand against...
You wait.
Such an unbelievable stand against the political ruling class, against the corruption of Yanukovych. It stirs up all the right feelings, really. Such a life-affirming 20 minutes of film. And really, frankly, overpowers anything else in its significance to me. Because it was just such a powerful... I thought... and beautiful moments like the people who join this... President Yanukovych added in some crazy last-minute law changes, didn't he? To kind of suppress the will of the people. And one of them was no protective headwear. So what did people do? They used pots and pans from the kitchen and sieves and the most ridiculous hats you've ever seen. Little things like that made me really like the human race, Paul.
Except it did reaffirm the kind of dullness of Western liberal democracies who no one's engaged
in. Indeed.
And that
is the point.
It's a shame that it's a difficult one, because it shows those countries up to be a kind of like, this sounds awful, but a little bit backwards
they
and
are.
Chaotic.
No, that's fair enough.
And very emotional and very polarised, whereas ours is a very dull, disengaged one that's going, we're all going to end up in the same
hell. Dribbling into a cup.
Yeah, we're all going to, we're all driving towards the same hell. They're just doing it quicker than us.
And just
in a less civilised way.
And the fact that there were some, indeed, but there were incredibly young people doing it, incredibly old people doing it.
Absolutely.
Just beautiful. If you are a socialist, you would love the
No, I agree. I mean, it is good. I think I was trying to think. I didn't think it's been a particularly good year for documentary because we did a couple. And I
last year was outstanding. This year a bit less so. Last year we did the
North Korean guy and Spanish guy. Which was dreadful.
I mean, the Oscar ones are actually pretty good. I mean, Amy was fine. Cartel Land was fine as well. This was fine. Yeah, it's up and down. Of course, most things are, but. We did that Welcome to Leith as well, didn't we? That American one. That was okay.
Oh, I quite like that one.
Yeah, that was okay. So, again, not a terrible year by any means. Right, Paul. Our last nomination for Film of the Year. And it's one that, again, I don't think either of us had a proper go on, to be fair. I think I said a bit more than you about it. So, Le Tout Nouveau Testament. The Brand New Testament. Which is yet another one that didn't make it onto the final Oscar list this year, Paul.
Which was baffling. Cause, yes. It's from Belgium. And I think all Belgian films should be on the Oscar list.
Indeed. That's a great shout.
Especially if they have Benoit Poulvardor in, which who I love particularly, as well as Catherine Deneuve hooking up with a gorilla.
Oh, man, that is... You know... That's my second moment of the year, the last 20 minutes of Winter on Fire.
And again, Jaco van Dormael, who's done some of the truly great Belgian films that are original, witty and challenging, controversial... that it's just baffling. And basically it's about God. God is living in Brussels with his daughter.
Yeah.
And she manages to get out on the streets and he goes in search of her. And basically the adventures of God's daughter whilst he's trying to track her down. I think it's all over the place, but that's what's so good about it.
Yes.
And the performances are excellent. It's witty, it's funny, it's insightful. It's not anti-religious. It's very neutral on that, if not positive.
It is, yeah.
But actually about religion per se.
It does play with it.
Absolutely. It plays with it. It tries to... It does kind of take the mickey out of it in the sense of it being a kind of gentle one, but with some real insight there. And plus, it's beautifully performed by the young girl as the daughter. And Benoit Poulvardor as God is equally brilliant. And again, you've got Catherine Deneuve in there hooking up with a gorilla. What more can you say? I think this was last year. It was a film I recommended that we talk about that we hadn't reviewed, and then we did review it, which we'll talk about that in a minute to yours as well. And so, but an excellent film.
Yep, absolutely. Very enjoyable. And above all else, very clever, Paul.
Indeed.
It's surprise as this isn't to say, it's quite a ridiculous premise, this. Obviously. But just go with it, and you'll have a great time with this film. And it's to that end, I'm happy to see past some of the negative points of it. That being said, the special effects really, really, really let this film down for me. I'm thinking specifically about that bloody awful singing fish. Of which I've seen better elsewhere a thousand times, including Tower of Tales. The dancing hand on the table is awful. The bird is awful. Now, whatever the reason is, and there's no excuse for that, frankly, considering, for example, Tower of Tales, which I think had a lot better special effects than this, probably had a similar budget to this, I would say. And that did a great job for me on special effects. This was just truly, truly awful special effects. And it does. On it, they are that bad. They
it
do,
jars.
They do detract. I'm not just saying that for the sake of it. They really do.
No, I would agree.
It does feel a tiny bit long.
I agree.
And it does end quite suddenly, which is a little bit odd. But the overall structure works so well of kind of splitting the whole film up into different apostles and their stories. Because that's what the Brand New Testament is. She escapes from the house with her father where she goes through a washing machine. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
She comes out the other end of the washing machine. And her job is to rewrite the whole of religion. And she has to hire six apostles and their stories to make the Brand New Testament.
I'm glad you reminded me of that.
Yeah, because there's 12 apostles, but because the mother likes baseball, which is another funny thing, she's got a set of 18 baseball cards.
God's wife.
Therefore, it's got to be... God's wife, yeah. Therefore, it's got to be 18 apostles because the baseball team is 18. Fantastic stuff.
And I think his name's Francois Damiens, who I really, really like as another Belgian actor, who's been in a lot of stuff with Danny Boone, the French film, comedian stuff. And I think they work very well. So one of the apostles is François Damiens. He's a hitman, isn't he?
An assassin, yes, that's right.
And again, it works really well. There's a homeless man as well.
There's a homeless man. But, you know, if all else fails, if none of this convinces you, it's got Catherine Deneuve sleeping with a gorilla.
Indeed.
Now, that alone ensures its place on any film of the year list. And you can't get any better than that, really.
You can't.
So, fair play to her. She looks dreadful, by the way. Really, really dreadful. Anyway, that poor gorilla is all I can say about that. Paul, what's your film of the year?
Well, I suppose I'm going to have to go with Sweet Bean.
Ah.
Which I thought was magnificent. I loved it, and I loved the narrative, and I thought what it showed that made it so much better than everything else, which actually demeaned everything else, apart from one or two of them, was that at the heart of it is a true sense of humanity.
Yep.
And it made you realise how rare that is.
Especially for Japanese cinema.
Both in society and in cinema. I think Usmana Limelight has it a bit, and probably A Pigeon Sat on the Beach, but actually that true sense of humanity that Sweet Bean captures. And again, which is quite fascinating, you making me watch a disability movie again.
You can blame Eric Innes for this.
And so, given your obsession that I make you watch disability films, you've made me watch one, which is the film of the year.
Well, I mean, that's interesting. I mean, to that point, what I remember about Sweet Bean, so many shots of leaves through sunlight. And not particularly attractive leaves, just leaves. And sometimes these scenes don't have any music or even sound effects in them. So that's how earthy this film is, really. That's a worthy winner.
What about for you?
For me, it's Pigeon. For me, it is Pigeon. 2016 has been a terrible year for me personally, Paul, frankly. And it's not been that great for the world either.
It's exactly the same for the world.
Oh, it just feels that
people
much worse.
People die and...
Indeed, but
countries crikey. Kill one another.
This film was the one, above all else for me, I'd recommend that would inform, educate, but above all else entertain, Paul. It's a complete film.
Mm.
And somehow manages to be a brilliant piece of escapism, despite it being so fucking real. It's the most real film on this list, and yet I just escape into this beige world and have an absolutely amazing time. To be honest, for most of the year, and this may surprise you, Winter on Fire was my pick. But actually, when I really studied it, and when I realised how much of a socialist fucking thing it was...
That made you not want to choose it.
It had to be, out of stubbornness alone. Then, and actually, to be fair, I've never seen anything quite like Pigeon. I have got his box set now, Roy Anderson.
I'm glad to hear it.
And I've been that busy doing all these other bloody films that I will actually make the time to watch it over January while we have the January off, but... I think we've got two worthy winners there, Paul.
Absolutely.
Two incredibly strong winners. And some awesome runners-up, by the way.
Mm.
What's interesting, by the way, is that I actually preferred Usmana to Sweet Bean, personally. Mm. There's a little few extra touching moments to me in that. But again, great films.
Indeed.
Lots of great films. So indeed. If you haven't seen any of these yet, and also included A Man Called Over, out of habit for the fact that we'll be talking about it next year at some point, probably again, then yes, watch and watch. So, Paul... So now that we've crowned, and now we're just going to have a bit of dessert before we finish, what would you recommend we haven't reviewed on the podcast?
Well, I think Sweet Bean wins hands down.
Yep.
I would say there were three other films that I watched that I was going to talk about, but I'll give them a mention. And bizarrely, one of them was, which I've only just got round to watching, was your film, either last year or the year before, of things you'd seen that you liked, and that was The Great Passage.
Right.
About the construction of a dictionary.
Oh, yes. You liked that, did you?
And which I thought was beautiful.
It was a beautiful film.
It was a beautiful film. And I would put it up there as second to Sweet Bean as the film of the year. And then Usmana Limelight, followed by A Pigeon, etc. But the two other films I would mention that actually have come out this year were Goldstone, which is an Australian film, which is a sequel to Mystery Road, which we did review. which is about an Aboriginal detective policeman and his work in a kind of white community. And also the Hollywood film Hell or High Water with Jeff Bridges and Chris Pine. Now, we don't usually mention Hollywood, but it tapped right into my socialism, you'll be glad to hear.
Oh, fuck this film, man.
Because it's actually about the destructive nature of American capitalism.
Oh, fuck the...
to the extent, which was a stunning piece of work in the sense that you've got a major corporation making a film with major money that's telling you capitalism is shit and will destroy us all.
Not interesting.
But that was interesting because it wasn't what you'd have expected. But Goldstone is the sequel to Mystery Road, which had Hugo Weaving in it.
Oh, Weaver.
We did review it either last year or the year before. And basically he goes back into a kind of central mining town in Australia to look for a missing girl. And it involves the trafficking of Chinese women and the corruption of the local police. And it's a devastating view of Australian culture, racism, ignorance and greed, and the kind of total moral bankrupt landscape of Australia. And it has a lot of things that actually made me think of Sweet Bean, which is about our place within the environment and the environment within us as well. And I think, so I'd recommend Goldstone.
Yeah, and if people remember back to last year, I put forward a British film in this slot, even though it was British by virtue of the director's passport only. This year, it's actually a British film.
And I watched it.
Yeah. It's called Ah, and it's what happens if humans lived like apes, basically.
It's dreadful.
Here's the thing. It's got Noel Fielding in it, which enables, you know, our domestic listeners at least to get a grasp on what level of human crassness this film reaches here. It's bollocks, but at the same time, I loved it. I laughed out loud frequently.
You're
it's
a sad
stupid,
case.
It's silly. But actually, if you want to look at all the stuff behind all the frolics, you can see some sort of commentary about teenage pregnancy, alcohol dependency, British attitudes towards everything, really, excessive commercialism, TV and all the rest of it. Or it's people just making noises and throwing food at each other. Watch it and decide for yourself.
Unless it says written, directed, produced and stars by Orson Welles. Any other name that follows that sentence should be avoided. And this is one. And it's very interesting because you were choosing it, I watched it.
Yeah.
I was astounded at how bad it was. Because I did like Sightseers, which you've written before and performed in. And I quite like that. But this was just
shite. When we're that divisive, you have to watch it. You have to. Simple, you have to.
God. Shite.
Yeah, loved it. Great stuff. and what I normally do when you recommend films is completely ignore them. So Goldstone can fuck itself. And that bloody
you
social...
You quite like Mystery Road.
That socialist shit can really piss off.
Yeah, you won't like that.
So, Paul, the final bit of business for the year is what are we looking forward to for 2017? Now, the thing is, you won't be around as much. We know that already.
Indeed.
But therefore, I will allow you then to commentate first on what we've now discovered is the December shortlist for the Oscar Foreign Language Films 2017. Now, there are 10 nominations, and these will get whittled down to about five or six. So just tell us a little bit about them and who's been put forward and which ones have been missing, which is the bigger story, actually.
I think quite a lot of the ones we've been talking about, particularly Almodovar's Julieta.
Obviously Verhoeven's Ella, which I've been incredibly looking forward to talking about the podcast.
Absolutely. Quite amazing omissions, given that we have, in fact, both seen a couple of them are on it.
Yeah.
For example, A Man Called Over.
Yeah.
And again, how that is on it and Julieta isn't, it is amazing. And even Elle, it should be on it over and above that. And I really liked Man Called Ode, so that's not... But I would say the thing I'm looking forward to most of it is actually The King's Choice, the Norwegian one, which stars a Danish bloke as the king.
They're all the same.
he's in a lot of the films we've ever watched, the Danish films. And also Tony Erdmann. Now, I actually have seen Tony Erdmann.
And you enjoyed it.
And it's an exceptional film.
We will talk about it next year.
Because I know that it got standing ovations and everybody loved it at Cannes and Venice and all of the big film festivals. And it's a wonderfully lovely little film. It's not big budget. It's about people. And
it's a father trying to get back with his strange daughter, isn't it? Something like that.
Yeah, she overworks and she's very corporate and he's much more of a kind of... social worky kind of person, and it's about trying relationships, and it works very well. The one I'm not particularly looking forward to see is Tanner, the Australian one. You get the feeling it's going to be one of those kind of films that they're liking it because it's got, you know,
naked bodies near flames
and the kind of ethnic minorities in it.
Yeah,
as a kind of tokenism. They can be great films.
Yeah, of course they can.
You do feel it's in there for.
Well, we did Chinese Country, didn't we? And that was put forward by Australian.
Absolutely.
Film.
Absolutely. I mean, was a great film.
This list. I mean, probably the most notable omission of all, Paul, is the Finnish entry, "The Happiest Day in the Life of Olli Mäki," which won Uncertain Regard at the Cannes Film Festival. Yeah. That didn't make it onto the list. It's a boxing film. Don't know whether they think only they can do decent. Who knows what the reasons are?
Yeah, they probably just thought he's white. He can't be a good boxer.
Well, yeah, I think it was actually shot in black and white, wasn't it? which is why they've already done that. So yeah, anyway,
it's a Raging Bull. Yeah, Raging Bull.
What's this shit, Raging Bull? I'm not putting this forward. So I mean, you've got the Australian film Tanner. You've got a Canadian film. It's only the end of the world. Like, it will feel like the end of the world after you watch this. Only the end of the world because it's Canadian. Canadian cinema sucks. You got another Danish film, and this is, for my reckoning, Paul, the third year in a row there's been a Danish entry. Mm-hmm. So they bloody love their Scandinavian stuff, as proven by some other nominations here. It's a war film. I'm not exactly looking forward to seeing that, but we will. Tony Erdman, I've heard lots of great things. Your recommendation as well. We'll obviously review that fully next year.
It's our kind of film.
It is, yeah. I'm up in the air about The Salesman from...
I'm a bit concerned that it'll be a typical kind of Arabian kind of film that we've seen before.
We have seen, as Garfer had, is we've done his other two films. Yeah. A Separation was a masterpiece.
Yeah.
And then that other one was a bit less so.
Yeah.
So I have a feeling this will be even less so. If he follows the same fucking format he's been following...
And this is about a couple breaking down while making Death of a Salesman.
It is basically their version of The Salesman. Yeah. Death of a Salesman. But the thing is... is that Hollywood actually thinks he's the only non-European director in existence. So that slightly concerns me. I agree. I'm looking forward to The King's Choice because Norwegian cinema, I think people know, I'm not that enamoured with it as much as I am with the Danish and the Icelandic and the Swedish stuff. So I want them to impress me with this. And it's a Danish Scandinavian royalty is bloody wonderful. Mm. It looks always beautiful. The costumes are always that much more elaborate than anything other form. So yeah, that's good. Russian film, I like Russian cinema.
What's interesting about that one is it's directed by Andrei Konchalovsky.
Yep.
Who did The Runaway Train with John Voight and Eric Roberts.
Bloody hell.
And he's done a lot of Hollywood shit.
But now, is this him going back?
And he's gone back home.
Right.
And actually, I think that's going to be very interesting that he is an established Hollywood director who's made some quality films as well as some, you know, pulp, shy and stuff. And he's gone back. Because I read that name and I thought, oh, that seemed terribly familiar. And I was looking through his filmography and I thought, oh, that's shit.
Yeah.
You know, or just schlock stuff. And so I'm actually quite looking forward to that.
I wonder if it'll be 3.5 hours long. What I forgot the name of the other Russian entry that made it. Leviathan.
And Winter's Tale. Oh, no,
I love Leviathan. That was my favourite of that year.
I bet you it's not like we would traditionally expect, because it's a man who knows Hollywood.
Yeah, so you wouldn't do it 3 hours long. And also, bearing in mind that Trump loves Putin, then I think he's actually got a chance of winning, Paul. Swedish, A Man Called Over, we've talked about, and we'll talk about it again, although I'd rather not. Now, the final entry that's made onto this list, Paul, is... a Swiss film, which is odd anyway.
It's an animation, isn't it?
It's an animation. My Life as a Courgette.
Or Zucchini.
Zucchini. We will see on that. We will see. It's interesting to see an animation film on this list. Because obviously the animations have their own Oscar. So we'll have to see. It's on this list. We'll have to see if it makes it to the other list. Because if it doesn't, what does that mean? It's here on story alone in this list.
Now, European animation is usually a bit shit.
But this is stop motion. So we know what we're going to get with that. So this has to be, Paul, an emotional masterpiece. For it to fight through the stop motion shit animation and make it onto the Oscar list for 2017 for foreign language. No?
Indeed.
So we shall have to see about that. Just before we go then, a few other things to let people know about. And as you longer term listeners know, when we talk about films that we are looking forward to doing, and when we say we're going to do them, we're going to do them. So one thing we're going to do next year as well is A Mohican Comes Home, Paul. A Mohican Comes Home. The most recent film from Suichi Okita, the director of A Story of Yonosuke, which we both loved. It was in our top, I think it was both of our top fives for that year we did the podcast. We didn't get his 2014 film over here, but this is his most recent film, and it's coming to the UK shores in 2017.
At the Mac, one presumes.
Yep. Yeah.
Mentioned it earlier.
Yeah, it's going to be obligatory viewing for sure. And you can definitely expect that to be on the podcast, as well as a bunch of other Japanese films, Paul, because we ain't given up on this stuff yet when it's at the height of its powers. Also, and this is interestingly enough as well, new films from David Robert Mitchell, who directed It Follows, M. Night Shyamalan, who has borrowed the director of photography from It Follows, and here's one for you, Paul, Lynn Ramsey. Why is that important? Do you remember?
She's the Scottish director, isn't she? Yep. Got sacked from a film for trouble before.
This is her first film since We Need to Talk About Kevin, which was a masterpiece. A British.
We didn't review that. Though.
We did, that was years ago. It was a British masterpiece, and this is her first film since then. And I've got a feeling you're looking at 7+ years, Paul.
Well, she was making that one in between that she got. I think it was her.
I think it was a short, though.
No,
she got sacked.
She got sacked,
and then she did a short, and then she's done nothing. Now she's doing this. And not only is this, is that reason enough to be excited, Joaquin Phoenix is in it.
Joaquin Phoenix.
So there we fucking go.
Well, obviously, I'm looking forward to anything Ken Loach makes as a socialist.
If I, as a final point, because you know,
I'm joking. His film's quite difficult.
I will give you the final word, Paul, since we're about to end this for the year. How was I, Darcy Blake? How was it? Is it Darcy Blake? Daniel Blake? What's his
Daniel
name?
Daniel Blake.
Daniel Blake.
You're thinking Darcy Bustle.
Darcy Bustle.
We know where your mind
is. I would
goes.
Rather look up her skirt than watch a socialist fucking benefits film.
It was meaningful and earnest.
Oh, lovely. Oh, that's just great.
And great performances.
Oh, that's just wonderful.
No, I think it's funny because I've watched a couple of kind of YouTube things about films coming up in the year. And Hollywood is so trapped in franchises.
Oh, it's remaking everything.
That it's remaking it, and it's on the fifth version or sixth version of something, or they're rebooting. They even call them a reboot now.
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
And it's just really, really sad, and I'm so glad we do this.
Yes, and I think all our listeners are as well, because we've got Sweet Bean and a Pigeon Sat on a Branch reflecting on existence that nobody else has talked about this year.
There you go.
Even though they have come out this year on disc. So there we go, folks. Thank you ever so much for all of your ears that you've gave us over the year. Sorry for that massive break in the middle. There's going to be another little bit of a break now as we all have January off, and then we will all be back, myself, Eric Hillis, Alex Sargent and Paul Dark, as we go through all the Oscar-nominated films, the main ones, the documentaries, the foreign language six that make it through, and, of course, the animation. We'll do all that stuff. So the only thing I want to say before we go is if some of you would be so kind as to give us a rating on iTunes, please. Just click on. Don't bother writing a review. We just want your stars, because that would help. That would help our ever-increasing listenership get to higher and higher. That would be absolutely great. You'll find us on iTunes, as you know already, by typing in the Outside Centre Film Podcast. That's all I want to say about that. Until February, folks, thank you very much. And from myself and Paul, a very happy new year.